But I'll tell you one thing I would stay away from. I would stay away from the insinuation that these young people who are inspired by Bernie Sanders are dupes and that somehow they're being fed misinformation and that's why they're enthusiastic.
Recent article came out talking about millennials, the younger generation by and large. Millennials and, of course, the generation that came after them. And the information was fairly positive. Dig this. So the current generation, right, the kids that are coming up now, they are consuming less alcohol. I thought that that was pretty positive. They are also using fewer illegal street drugs. Also, very positive. I liked hearing that. Also, smoking less cigarettes. Less of them are taking up smoking. Now, fewer of them are also getting their licenses. That part, I'm not so sure what that's about. Perhaps public transportation in some places is getting better and they're feeling like they just don't need it. Perhaps they're becoming more conscious about the environment. Who can say? But let's get to those other ones, right? They're drinking less, they're smoking less, they're using less illegal drugs. So if they're doing less of that, what are they doing more of? Or are they doing more of? Or are they just maybe the whole straight edge thing is coming back? No. Here's what they are doing, though. They're spending a hell of a lot more time in front of the black mirror, which is what I refer to when I'm talking about smartphones, tablets, cell phones, televisions, computers. Let's get into it, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 199. 199, it sounds like we're on sale. We are not. We are merely just one episode away from 200 of these things. My name is Melvin. Thank you for being here. Man, am I glad you're here. I do enjoy our time together every week. So this past week, I heard somebody put forth the notion that Donald Trump was created by the internet. Now, that sounded absolutely nuts to me. It shouldn't, because I do this every week in front of this microphone, and I point out the insane things that are on the internet. But he said, look, here's what's happening. Yeah, we have more access to information than we've ever had before. And that's one of the things that I'm constantly pointing out. I go, hey, all this information's out there, and it's good information. Why does everybody have so much bad information? And he says, what the internet has allowed us to do with all these social networks, especially. And by the way, social networks, the whole idea that was said to us, the entire premise that was fed to us was, this is a good way for you to keep in touch with friends. Here's how you can reach out to people from far away. Here's how you can connect yourself to the world. But what has happened? Everybody does nothing but go to their quiet little corners of the internet where they only have to see what they want to see, only have to hear what they want to hear. And then I decided to explore that further. Now, let me say up front, I have four open screens in front of me right now. I've got a computer, which I do this show on. I've got a large monitor so I can actually watch the sound waves that are happening as I'm doing the show to make sure that everything is going out like it's supposed to. I also have another screen open for the audio clips, and then I have another. It's embarrassing. So I'm currently in front of four of these black mirrors that I'm complaining about. But here's the thing. When this show goes off, these screens, by and large, go off as well. I heard another gentleman talking this week about how he took a plane trip cross country. And I've taken that trip from DC to Portland, and it's about 7-8 hours, and it's usually on several different airplanes, two or three airplanes. And he said he sat down, he's a guy in his 60s, he sat down and he said the kid next to him was just buried in this game. And he said, you know, I've been taking planes for 30, 40 years now. And he goes, I remember when you used to get on a plane, you would turn and talk to the person next to you. And that's how you met people, right? Or just how you engaged with a stranger for a little bit. He says, and if you looked around the plane, everybody was talking. If you looked around the terminal, everybody was talking. And he says, but if you look now, it's everybody's got their face buried in these cell phones. Now, hearing this, obviously, what I do at first when I hear these things is I immediately look at myself. I'm the subject of mirrors. I turn it on me and I go, what the hell do I look like? How much time am I spending on this thing? Am I perhaps more ignorant to the world because of this? Maybe I don't know what's going on. Maybe I'm only spending time in the quiet corners of no. You know, that's not true about me. I spend more time with Right Wing Radio than I really care to admit. So a gentleman named Dan Hoyle, and Dan Hoyle did a one-man show called Each and Everything. This is from an article back in 2014, so almost 3 years ago. It was done kind of mid-late 2014. And Each and Everything was about the loss of humanity due to the cell phone culture, the internet culture. And quoting from the article here, the essence of Hoyle's show is the search for something more ineffable. Real human connection, the kind built from eye contact instead of Facebook likes. In a world in which our behavior in public space is increasingly isolated and isolating, we've all seen what Hoyle is talking about, such as a couple out on a date, both staring down at their phones, pedestrians locked so deep into Facebook or Twitter that they barely avoid bumping into each other, a subway car in which every single commuter is thumbing his or her way through Instagram or Imgur or Candy Crush, so on and so forth. Phone zombies everywhere. A plague of the digital undead that swept across the world before we fully realized what was happening. And the reason why it took us so long to realize what was happening is because we too were too busy staring at our smartphones. He points out that we need to find a new balance between our machines, which, by the way, are very helpful because, allow me to point out, information, all the whole world at your fingertips, right? Even international calling is no longer a super expensive thing because you can just do it over Skype and then it's free and everybody's got access to these things. You know, you can buy things online and you don't have to go out anymore. So these things, they are very helpful and they are a lifeline. And the kids I started talking about at the beginning of the show who aren't getting into drugs and drinking and smoking as much anymore because they're into this. So there is an upside, but there is also this downside. And the emergence of the smartphone as our default interface with basically everything has altered something significant about how we behave in public. Quoting from the article here, it's one thing when we are all alone in our homes connecting online like we used to do in, say, the 90s. But when we're out in public checking our phones, we're creating new private spaces in a public arena. Something has changed. You have 5 minutes to kill. And instead of looking around, maybe having some random conversation with a stranger, maybe just sharing some glances, we're looking at our phones. I think these technologies enable a level of self-isolation that is greater than before. Reality is awkward. And life through a screen is just a little less awkward. Guilty. I find myself, if I have even a fleeting moment, reaching for that damn phone. Now, wait a minute. Stop. Don't. Hey, easy. You don't have to do that. In prep for this week's show, I became a lot more conscious of how often I rely on my machine. There is a rule in my household, in Casa de Melvin, that there are no devices at the table. And it's not just smartphones. It's tablets, computers, none of it at the dinner table. And whenever we can, and we're not always able to eat together because we're all on different schedules, but whenever we're all home together, and it's just about the dinner hour or lunch hour, depending on what day of the week it is, we make sure to all sit down together and we encourage conversation. Now, I've got two teenagers, which means that the conversation isn't always great, but it is still a conversation. And these days are the days that your kids are going to remember. Right? They're going to remember a funny face that you made. They're going to remember something that you said to them. They're going to remember when you were focused on them and not on your damn phone. No one's ever going to look back and say, hey, remember that one time when we were out at the public park and we were all staring at our phones and we did that on and off for about 2 hours and then we went home and stared at our phones again? Wasn't that a great day? Nobody says that. And if the kind of ignorance, the level of ignorance that we have in America today, not just in America, you know, the kind of fear and neoliberalism that has taken hold in America seems to be sweeping across much of Europe as well. And if it is in part or thanks to these machines that we so heavily rely on, I think that it's time that each and every one of us takes a look at ourselves. Right? Don't just look around at other people. I mean, do that too. But certainly look at yourself. How often are you using this damn thing? Are you ever just sitting there and allowing yourself to get bored? Remember, if you allow yourself to sometimes sit there and get bored, that's when you're creative. I hear a lot of folks say, well, I do a lot of my thinking on the toilet. Well, I don't. I try not to spend a lot of time there. But I do, Melvin here, I do a lot of my thinking while I'm running. I don't run with music in my ears. I haven't for years now. Man, at least 5-6 years I gave up music while I was running. Because I realized, one, to be safe, I want to hear all the crap that's going on around me. You know, I want to get hit by a car or something. And then the other thing, I noticed that my thoughts just race. I have a problem getting to sleep at night sometimes because there are so many things running through my head. A very active imagination. And I said, you know what, if perhaps I did this thinking, you know, not while I'm at work and, you know, not while I'm trying to pay attention to my wife and kids, but perhaps if I had another time of the day where I was doing this thinking, right, perhaps a time when I'm not staring at my smartphone, perhaps a time when I'm not watching television or listening to music or reading a book. I said, oh, I could do all this thinking while I'm, and when I'm running now, I do all of that thinking, and it's where I get a lot of the ideas for the show. It's where I get a lot of song ideas. It's, you know, things of that nature. And I'm creating all the time because of it. You know, when I think about my business and all this, you know, I come up with easier ways to do things. That's when creativity happens, when you allow your mind to just be idle for a little bit. If at the first sign of boredom, you're reaching for that damn phone, just take your hand, take, you know, reach out with your right hand, take your left hand, grab your right hand, and start pulling back on that hand and go, wait a minute. Is there something else I could be doing with this time? Now, I'm the worst with as far as this goes because I feel like if I exist, I have to be producing. If I exist, I have to be working. If I am here, there is definitely something that I'm supposed to be doing, but I'm changing, and I'm changing for my own good. I'm changing for the better. I'm changing for the better of those around me. And I'm realizing that I don't always have to be doing something. I don't always have to be creating. You know, it's not just wake up, you got to make money. Because now, thanks in large part to the way that we communicate or don't communicate. Thanks in large part to the way we get our information or don't get our information. Now, we live in a world where everything is true and yet nothing is true.
You have provided zero evidence that the president's claim that he would have won the popular vote if 3 to 5 million illegal immigrants hadn't voted. Zero evidence for either one of those claims.
Well, it's thanks right. A lot for joining us this morning.
That was George Stephanopoulos on ABC, and I'm seeing more and more news shows where the hosts, if they belong to a legitimate media outlet, are just throwing their hands up and whether they say it outright or whether they just kind of, they bury their head in their hands. No. Get the hell out of here. Come on. No, what you just said is not. Get. We're not doing this. You're killing the credibility that's left on my show. Get out of here. And it's happening because a lot of folks believe a lot of things that simply are not true. There's an article called 50 Things that have been killed by technology. And I'm not going to go through all 50 of them. Some of them I'm glad are gone, such as VHS tapes. That was never a really great outlet. Using public phones, I was never a gigantic fan of that anyway. Now, here's a few things. Calling up the cinema to find out movie times. Now, they automated that a long time ago, so I guess that's not as big a deal. But booking tickets over the phone, talking to another human being. That's definitely one of the things that are missing. Printing photos. Most of us just keep our photos on our phone or our computer. You know, I've been encouraging my wife to print them out for some time. Here we go. Here's a big one. And if you're not doing this, you should definitely do this. Okay, handwritten letters. Now I understand we can just get on. We can do a text or we can send a picture of our ding dong to someone we love or whatever. No. Don't do that. What you should do. There's nothing better. There's nothing in the world like it. And my wife gets at least one handwritten letter a year from me, but it's hardly ever one. It's usually two or three. You know, I make sure to still do that. One, I love writing. I love writing. I'm not so great with the typing. I'll do it if I have to, but I really like handwritten things. I suppose that just makes me kind of old school. But handwritten letters, and especially a handwritten love letter. If you have not now, and this is easy, and this is cheap, you've not written, say, a love letter to your significant other, your wife or your boyfriend or whatever, it is, first of all, cheap and easy. It costs you no money, you know, except for the paper and the pen, but please, you're getting trivial on me. Write them just a handwritten letter. Hand it to them, or put it someplace where they can find it. It's going to be very sweet, and they're going to read it, and they're going to treasure it. And it's not just going to go into the digital trash can. You know, they're going to hold on to it, and they're going to cherish it. You know, these are the things that, I understand it's old-timey, but it's also very personal. It shows that you took some time with it, you know. With typing now, you can do talk-to-text. You can spend literally no time on something, and it shows. Do a handwritten letter. I think you'll surprise yourself. Making mixtapes. We make playlists now, but it's just not the same. Using an address book, a physical address book. Here's another thing that I think we suffer when we don't do. Going into the bank. Now, it's very convenient to be able to do things online. Oh, yes, it's true. I admit, Melvin here, I have gone into my bank about 3 times in the last 5 or 6 years. The first time was to open my account. The second time was to get a home loan. And the third time was to open my retirement account. Everything I've done since then, I've done online. I'm sorry. I'm bad for myself. And I'm not talking to human beings. We're all learning about ourselves right now, okay? Here's another one. Buy CDs or have a CD collection. In this room, if you could see how ridiculous, I probably own about 1,400 physical CDs. That's not digital albums. It's actual CDs. I guess, by and large, I'm pretty old-timey. Newspapers. We don't read physical newspapers anymore. And a lot of newspapers are going by the wayside because of that. We need to start doing that again. Buying flowers from an actual florist. Not going on to 1-800-Flowers. Going in and talking with an actual human being. Keeping a personal diary. I did this for years. You know, it's the whole handwritten thing. And I loved doing it. But once I started the business and, you know, I started doing this show more and things started piling up, I wasn't able to keep it up. But I did it for about 7-8 years and just loved it. Postcards. By the way, those are something that never get, it's that whole handwritten thing again. Postcards. You know, it's very cheap. It's like 40 cents or some crap like that. Send a postcard. Might even be cheaper than that. Might be 32 or 33. I mean, it's not a lot. Clearly, I haven't sent a postcard in a while. But that's another thing. A handwritten postcard to somebody from wherever you're from. Not just a picture, you know, that you took on your smartphone and you sent it to everybody you know. You posted it to the Book of Faces. No, no, no. Try sending a postcard from wherever you're from. I swear the people on the other end, they're going to love it. You're going to go home after and you're going to find it on their fridge. It's going to be fantastic. It's antiquated by and large. You know, I understand that. And I understand I come from a whole different school, you know, and I don't want to be one of those guys that says my generation had it correct, because there were a lot of things that my generation had wrong as well. But some of these things I talked about, like with the flowers, like with going into your bank and talking to a human being, things that connected us with other people, you know, allowing yourself to get bored for a minute so that you could be creative. I mean, I think a lot of our younger generation is suffering with the way that they communicate. And it's because they've learned to communicate online. I know in my house, my brothers, I was very shy, so I didn't have a lot of friends, but my brothers were always on the phone with their friends and with girls, always on the physical phone that was plugged into the wall. I haven't had a lot of interest in it, and it took me a long time to get used to the phone, but they always were. These, you won't find that these days because they do a lot of the talking on the you know, the texting and the emails and things of that nature. I suppose what I'm trying to convey here is the human connection, the human interaction. And I think if we have more of that kind of interaction, it's going to be a lot harder for us to lie to one another. It's going to be a lot harder for us to be cruel to one another. I have read the comment in a comment section more times than I like to admit that, quote, you should just go kill yourself. I've seen that in the comment section a freaking lot. You should just die. You should just burn. You should just choke to death on 1,000 D's or what. I've read horrible, horrible things in the comment section. And as a result, I tell my people, don't go near the comment section. Holy crap. If you want to lose all your faith in humanity, please, just don't go near the comment section. But I think if you had a person, a human being, a living, breathing human being standing in front of you, you would not say to them, you should go kill yourself, because you would have to hear yourself say that. You would have to see their immediate emotional response when you said that. And you would have to weigh the real world consequences of your words. You would not tell them to go choke on 1,000 D's or whatever the hell else they say in the comment section if a person was real and in front of you. And I think not just being nice, but also lying. I don't think you would have as easy a time lying to a person if they were standing right in front of you. But this is what we do these days. We say horrible, horrible things when we hide behind a keyboard, when we hide behind a black mirror, you know, on the other side of that black mirror. We say horrible things to each other. And we share a lot of things that aren't true, written by news sites that are there for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to spread a lot of falsehoods. And now there are a lot of people, and they tend to fall on one political ideological side, who live and breathe nothing but falsehoods now.
Trump is so fire-breathing, so energetic, so cunning, so real, and he's having results so amazing that it just makes me be endeared to Trump. I'm ready to die for Trump at this point. And I'm already ready to die for America. It's the same feeling I have for America, because he is America. You're America.
Meet Alex Jones if you haven't already. If you haven't already, bless you, man. Yay, where have you been? That's great. You must live in a fantastic world. But most of us know who this numbnuts is. And he became pretty popular during the MySpace days. That's about the time that his fake news, and it is, it's all conspiracies, it's all fake, he just makes things up, he's got sources on nothing, he just says things into the microphone, none of it's true, but he's a millionaire, and he's got millions of weekly listeners who hang on his every word, even though it's an absolute outright falsehood. There's an article over at Dead State by Sky Palma, and the headline reads, "Fake news site thanks gullible Trump supporters after reaching 1 million views." The owner of a fake web news site, quoting here, reached an impressive milestone this month just after a week of being in operation. The name of it is The Underground Report. And they received about 1 million views and hundreds of thousands of likes and shares on Facebook. So, in a post to his site this March 3rd, TRU's owner James McDaniel took the time to thank, quote, "the gullible Trump supporters who, without their inability to decipher fact from fiction, made the milestone possible." McDaniel mentioned how the website's disclaimer points out that TUR is a news and political satire web publication, but that didn't stop readers from embracing his stories as fact. So, whether you're angry about Obama's pedophile ring that he ran out of the White House, or Whoopi's statements about the U.S. military widows, calm down and grow up. Neither of them happened, he wrote. For his own amusement, he claims he started posting links in Trump fan groups on Facebook, and that's when things got out of hand. "To my surprise, the Trump masses embraced my stories as fact almost universally," he said. "It seemed there wasn't anything I could write that was too wild or outrageous to be believed by this particular audience." Quote, "If I wrote about CNN being fake news and connected to ISIS, readers would agree wholeheartedly with my fabricated article. If I wrote about a black liberal or Obama supposedly saying something controversial, the response was unbridled racism and hatred. When I wrote about Hillary's new emails that proved that she was a child-sacrificing maniac, people screamed for her head. I'm startled that in today's world, so many would be so willfully ignorant. It's truly a frightening time when a group of people screaming fake news at the top of their lungs live, eat, and breathe falsehoods.
There was a picture on the front page of the National Enquirer, which does have credibility, and they're not going to do pictures like that because they get sued for a lot of money if things are wrong, okay? A lot of money. And there was a picture. All I did is point out the fact that on the cover of the National Enquirer, there was a picture of him and crazy Lee Harvey Oswald having breakfast. This was a magazine that, frankly, in many respects, should be very respected. I mean, if that was the New York Times, they would have gotten Pulitzer Prizes for their reporting. I've always said, why didn't the National Enquirer get the Pulitzer Prize?
So that's President Dum Dum praising one of the biggest, fakest news sites out there. And by the way, it's National Enquirer has broken a couple of things in the past. But out of, say, the 5,000 stories that they have had over the last decade, maybe three of them turned out to be true. And perhaps that's why they did not get the Pulitzer Prize. But I think understanding the environment, first of all, why we are the way we are, how we got here, right? So often I still find people trying to explain to themselves, to people around them, how the whole Trump thing happened. If you spend a lot of time in this media, reading and talking to people, things of that nature, it's not that much of a surprise. The only thing that really surprised me was how wrong the polls were. But even I am getting to a point where that's not all that surprising when you look at how many voter suppression efforts are out there, courtesy of the GOP, of course. It's a very vast network that they have that helps spread these falsehoods. So this is how we got to this point. This is how we ended up with this guy. And this is how we've now ended up with a new healthcare bill that not only does nothing for anybody who is a working person, working people, voted for this guy overwhelmingly. And him and the Republicans have now come forward with a bill that is going to send the cost of their health care, and this is if they get to keep their health care, it's going to take the cost of their health care and it's going to skyrocket it 500-700% more than it is now. It's also going to give a $20 million tax breaks to each one of the CEOs of all the major health companies. Here's the thing. In Obamacare, it said a couple of things. It said you cannot sell fake insurance. A lot of people would have insurance. They would pay their premiums for decades, and then they would get sick, they'd get cancer, something major, and then they would get a rescission letter. Nope, your policy doesn't cover this. Bye-bye. And with Obamacare, it said you can't do that. You have to cover people. If you're going to carry them, right, and you can't say that they can't be on because of a pre-existing condition and all these things, if you're going to have them on there, well, then you have to pay for them when they get sick. Your health insurance, that's what you are. And a lot of people lost their health care plans. A lot of people lost their doctors. They go, dang gum, you Obama, I lost my health care plan, I lost my doctor. What that means, you didn't have a health care plan. That's exactly what that means. And then, yeah, some doctors said, you know what? I don't know what to think of this. And they said, no, I want out of the network. Because the way that we do things with respect to healthcare, honestly, as far as all the developed nations go, we really are the worst in the world for this. One of the other things that Obamacare said is that CEOs can't write off every penny that they make. Now, because there was a compromise, Republicans did get to write some of the Obamacare bill, even though every single one of them voted against it. But in the Obamacare bill, you couldn't write off more than $500,000 a year in CEO pay. With the new Republican bill, you can now write off $20 million a year of CEO pay, which means that you and I are going to pay tons more for health insurance. And you and I know you're excited about this because I certainly am, you and I now get to pay for the CEOs, you know, and their gigantic jets and their solid gold faucets and whatever the crap they buy. I don't pretend to know how the other half lives. You and I now get to pay their salaries. Yay, it's so exciting, right? We should be excited. No, this is crap. And this doesn't make any sense. And that's not even the best part. Oh my goodness. The best part. Oh, here's what you've been waiting for. 14 million people are going to lose their health insurance inside the first year. Yay! And within 10 years, 24 million will lose their health insurance. Right now, we've got somewhere in the neighborhood of 600,000 people a year that go bankrupt because of medical bills. And the vast majority of those people were insured. They had insurance and they still went broke because of medical bills. Huh. When you go to somewhere like Germany or Switzerland, zero? Zero? Big fat zero? Huh. Interesting. Okay. We lose, under Obamacare, somewhere in the neighborhood of 17 to 20,000 people a year who die because they don't have access to health care. That number is terrible, but it used to be a lot worse. It used to be in the 40,000s to almost 50,000 people that died every year because they didn't have access to health care. How many people in some of these northern European countries or in Canada and in Australia? None? Zero? Zip? Zilch? Wow. Wow. See how pro-life we are? Isn't that crazy? Here's another BS thing that is being fed to you right now about health insurance. The Republicans said, we need to be able to sell health insurance across state lines. I know you've heard this. If your ears have been open for even 5 seconds within the last 8 years, you have heard it said, we need to be able to buy health insurance across state lines. And because with competition, things were going to get cheaper. By the way, healthcare is not a business. It should not be a business. We're talking about life and death here, right? There's bigger things than numbers. We're talking about human beings' lives here. Here's the big lie about buying health insurance across state lines. The most obvious thing is all of the insurance companies will begin incorporating in the state where there is the least amount of regulation. And so that's what has to happen. The competition that will happen will not be health insurance companies trying to get their prices lower. It will be an absolute race to the bottom for all of these insurance companies. Right now, at this moment, you're being lied to by the Republicans. You can buy insurance across state lines. We can already do that. So what in the piss are the Republicans talking about when they say that we need to be able to buy health insurance across state lines? Every single state has its own insurance commissioner. You know, all 50 states. And I know I just had to call mine recently because I had to figure out who sold event insurance. I had to get event insurance for a gig that I was doing. And I was pointed to somebody who sold that insurance by my state insurance commissioner. Bam! How great is that? I'd never dealt with my insurance commissioner before. But the insurance commissioner enforces the states in that law. The insurance laws that are in that state are enforced by the commissioner. So when they say they want to be able to sell across state lines, what they're really saying is they would like your state to either A, not have a state commissioner enforcing your state's laws, or B, they would like the standards that your state has for insurance companies to be so low that they're allowed to sell fake insurance to you. Insurance that, yeah, on the front, it's going to be cheaper. But when you need it, it's not going to be there. Truth be told, the only people who love their insurance are the wealthy and those who have never, ever had to use it. I have health insurance now through my employer. And it's okay, but I prefer not to use it because anything, and I mean anything, I had to spend some time in the hospital and I go, oh my crap, I got these headaches. Oh, what is this? And I go, well, no, it's cool. I got insurance. And I still got a massive bill in the mail. And I call them up and they go, no, sir, that's what you, and I go, what the hell does my insurance pay for then? I don't know why anybody thinks that this is a great plan. There's an article over in the Washington Post. And the headline is, in a place of need, an unhealthy contradiction. And what it's about is it's about McDowell County, West Virginia, which is a state, a county especially, that went overwhelmingly for Donald Trump because they believed that he was going to make healthcare better. They believed that he was going to bring back coal country. You know, he was going to bring back coal for them because it's been devastated since coal has started going by the wayside as a form of energy. And part of the reason it's going by the wayside, it's very dirty. It's very expensive. It causes a lot of health problems. So, quoting here from the article, another morning, another list of patients and problems in the hands of 35-year-old Keisha Saunders. Diabetes, depression, heart disease, Robert needs lower blood pressure, Buffy needs prescriptions filled, Mary needs to lose 50 pounds so she can get what she really needs, which is a new hip. Again, the list extends to the bottom of Keisha's notepad as it has so many days since the Affordable Care Act mandated that everyone have health insurance. Unlike in Washington, D.C., where health care is a continuous policy debate, health care where Keisha is a nurse practitioner is a daily need to be filled. The high rates of chronic diseases in McDowell County have made it the county with the shortest life expectancy in the nation. It's also a place that voted overwhelmingly for President Trump, whose promise to repeal the ACA will soon affect nearly every patient that Keisha treats at her Tug Riffer Health Clinic in Norfolk, including the one waiting in exam room number two. How are you doing? She asked Clyde Graham, who is 54 and been out of work for 4 years. Quote, I had a sandwich, she says, and it jumped out of me for 3 days. I mean, it just burnt. Clyde Graham, 54, is an unemployed Medicaid patient with a host of health issues. Heartburn is just the latest problem for Clyde, a patient Keisha sees every 3 months. Like so many in this corner of Appalachia, he used to have a highly paid job in the coal mine. Company insurance covered all of his medical needs. Then he lost his job and ended up here, holding a cane and suffering not only from heartburn, but diabetes, arthritis, diverticulitis, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol. Because of the ACA, his visit is covered by Medicaid. Before the law, most West Virginians without children and disabilities could not qualify for Medicaid no matter how poor they were. The ACA, also known as Obamacare, expanded the program to cover more people, such as Clyde, who could depend on Keisha to fix his heartburn without having to worry about the cost. As for the other problems in his life, he has put his hopes in Trump, who came to West Virginia saying he'd bring back the coal mines, put people back to work. When Trump mentioned repealing Obamacare, Clyde wasn't sure what he might mean for Medicaid, but if he had a job and provided health insurance, he reasoned that he wouldn't need Medicaid anyway. So he voted for Trump, along with 74% of McDowell County. Tug River Health Association treats about 8,700 patients, resulting in more than 20,000 visits a year to its five clinics. In 2016, over 12,000 of those visits were from Medicaid, up from just over 5,000 in 2013 before the ACA took effect here. Without the ACA, many of those patients wouldn't be able to afford their care. Will they soon lose coverage? Will they stop coming to the clinic? Lately, Tug River's chief executive has been telling the staff that the key going forward is uncertainty. Now, Keisha came upon this particular profession because her brother Derek, who was uninsured, died of kidney cancer when he was 25. He realized there was something wrong. He waited too long to go in, and then he died at 25 of kidney cancer. Now, Tug Riffer also was recently able, because of the ACA, able to hire a psychologist who is now treating 180 people, many of whom are trying to overcome opiate addictions. So these people need health care, and they need it bad. And they got it because of the black guy in the White House. And then this white guy comes through their town in 2015 and 2016 and says what the black guy did was wrong. Right? And what those brown people from the South are doing, and what those brown people from the Middle East are doing, and what those brown people in Minnesota are doing, and what those brown people, vote for me. And I will kick out all the brown people, and I will replace your insurance with something way better. He came through and said to them, what the black guy did for you was nothing. Awful. It hurts you. And he said, all those black and brown people out there, all bad. They all bad. And the people of West Virginia bought this. And now they're facing the fact that they're likely going to lose their health insurance. Yeah, Medicaid also goes away with the new Republican health bill. They bought into this salesman's pitch. And now they're likely to lose their health insurance. And now the bill of goods that they're being sold is, hey, At least you're not black.
Martin Luther King Jr. was in jail, and the jailer came to him and said, you know what? What you're doing is wrong. He said, no, I'm doing is right. And then Dr. King asked the white guy, how much money do you make? And after Dr. King said, you need to be marching with us. And so the reality is many right. white brothers and sisters have been sold a bill of good. At least you're not a Negro. So that overlords and captains of industry who exploit the working class who are white tell them, yes, we're screwing you, but at least you're not a black person. If they would get rid of the bigotry and the racism and we could come together and forge a connection, we could turn this mother out.
So Hillary Clinton didn't do herself any favors when she went to West Virginia or when she referred to West Virginia, because she said to a corner of the country that's already devastated by the fact that they have lost so many coal mine jobs that we're going to shut coal down. What she should have done was pointed out how we're going to get people more work in the new energy sector rather than just talking to a devastated people and saying that we're going to take away even more of what you already have. At least she had the good sense to bring Elizabeth.
Donald Trump says he'll make America great. He means make it even greater for rich guys just like Donald Trump. For the guys who don't care how much they've already squeezed from everyone else. Great for the guys who always want more. Because that's who Donald Trump is. The guy who wants it all for himself. And watch out, because he will crush you into the dirt to get whatever he wants. That's who he is.
And we've seen exactly that scene play out. We've seen that particular thing come true. Now, Elizabeth Warren, bless her, she really did try to warn us. But with all of the things that happened in the campaign, even a superhero like Elizabeth Warren wasn't able to get through to us all.
She doesn't whine. She doesn't run to Twitter to call her opponents fat pigs or dummies. No. She just remembers who really needs someone on their side. And she gets up and keeps right on fighting for the people who need her most.
The ACA was never, ever the gold standard to me. I never, ever believed that that was going to be the thing that was going to save everybody. It's going to protect everybody. I saw it as a stepping stone to single-payer health insurance. And then, of course, the Democrats, in their infinite wisdom, decided to dump all over single payer during the 2016 election. But now that we see what the Republic is, that they're repeal and replace, they had absolutely nothing to replace it with, nor are they all that great at the repeal either. Now we're starting to take the idea of single payer a little bit more seriously. But I have defended the ACA on this mic for years because it does help people. It does save lives. I've personally known people that have whose lives have been bettered by the ACA, and then I've heard many, many more stories about people's lives that were saved because of the ACA. But the ACA wasn't the end all be all. And we all recognize that the ACA was not without its problems.
Look, I think the Obamacare was imperfect from the beginning, but I didn't hear anything from the Republicans about here's what we ought to be doing. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just saying get rid of that. Still 18% of our national economy is spent on health care in this country. As someone who's just been through the system, I know how tough this is, and I had all the gold-plated advantages. Mm-hmm. If I'm out there in the middle of the country and I've kind of worked hard all my life and I've got a 2 gas stations and a convenience store and something else, I think I'm doing pretty well. I get hit with what I've got at 45. Man, they're at sea. And that just shouldn't happen. It's a national security issue to find a way to make health care work for everyone.
And now these captains of industry are in charge. Over the weekend, Donald Trump just hired the 8th person that used to work for Goldman Sachs. 8 people. He now has 8 people who used to work for Goldman Sachs that now work inside his White House. 8. So after all that bluster, after all those visits, and after all that talk about helping the middle class, we've seen the exact opposite play out. And the truth, the real truth, the only people that are going to get any help from this particular president are the already fabulously wealthy.
When we talk about the Walton family, the wealthiest family in America, and when we talk about Walmart, understand that Walmart is the major beneficiary of welfare in America. Isn't it weird that many of the people who work at Walmart are on Medicaid, which you pay for? They're on food stamps, which you pay for. They're in government-subsidized housing that you pay for because the Walton family refuses to provide the wages and benefits their workers deserve.
And all of these tax cuts are not free. You and I get to pay for all of these things. This from Money Watch. Meet the 18 profitable companies that paid no taxes over the last 8 years. President Trump and the GOP leadership have vowed to reduce U.S. corporate taxes, arguing that the statutory 35% rate is far too high. But thanks to loopholes and tax minimization strategies, few large profitable corporations actually pay the 35% rate. Among the roughly half of Fortune 500 companies that were consistently profitable between 2008 and 2015 during Obama's presidency, the effective federal income rate was 21.2% over that 8-year period, according to a study from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. 18 of them, including General Electric and Priceline, paid no federal income taxes at that time. Facebook has been one of the largest benefactors of this strategy, by the way, circling back around to the beginning of the show, saving $5.8 billion over the last 8 years. And these tax savings, they're not free. You and I ultimately pay for these. So, who are the 18 companies that paid no taxes over the last 8 years and are just gushing about the new Trump presidency and what he's going to do for them now that he's going to screw over the working people? That's Pepco Holdings, PG&E Corporation, Wisconsin Energy, NiSource, International Paper, which is one of the Coke companies, First Energy, Priceline.com, Amos Energy, General Electric, American Electric Power, Ryder System, Duke Energy, Next Era Energy, Xcel Energy, Ameren CMS Energy, Sempra Energy, and Eversource Energy. Clearly, the energy companies are just choking here in America.
No one gets Christ more wrong than Christians.
So often we're being told that the government is not the answer. And by the way, when we say government, what we're talking about is people, because people are what make up the government. We, the people, elect representatives to go to Congress and work for us. So what we're essentially saying is that when we, the people, pick people, they're the wrong people. But when people are, say, they inherit their money, you know, the whole Calvinism thing, they're blessed by God, then it's fine. It's fine if those people are in charge, even though those people are unelected. And the idea that this huge mass of people, right, democracy, that in America, that democracy is tyranny, but being run by a small handful of people is a fantastic idea, brings me to another point. I'm currently reading The Alphabet Versus the Goddess by Leonard Schlein. And I'm currently in the chapter about the Hebrews and the Israelites. And please, don't let your eyes glaze over right now. Please stick with me. I want to explore the idea of democracy via the oligarchy along with monotheism versus polytheism. So, quoting from the book here, the Israelites' sectarian prejudice stood in sharp contrast to other religions during their time. Polytheism, which is many gods, poly, many, had many hierarchical layers. There were national gods, local gods, family gods, and even personal gods. A kind of golden rule existed among the ancients. Each person respected the gods of other peoples and expected their own gods would be respected in return. To everyone except the Israelites, it was self-evident that there were large numbers of gods and goddesses, and it was common for a culture to sample other religions and incorporate foreign features into its own. There is not a single recorded case of Egyptian followers of the god Thoth sacking the temples of those who honored Ptah. Adherents of Marduk did not kill those who worshipped Baal. Devotees of the militaristic heirs never attacked the followers of warlike Apollo. By their very nature, polytheistic religions fostered tolerance. Piety did not lead ineluctably to religious hatred as it has so often in history. Although there were many bloody conflicts fought over land, women, booty, or to avenge a perceived wrong, there were no religious wars in the ancient world. Monotheism. So now we're mono one, poly many. It's basic stuff. One plausible explanation. Monotheism does not mirror human society. Humans are first and foremost social animals. A deity who was alone, not by choice, but because there were no other companions for him, was not a concept without parallel in human society. The God of the Israelites did not have a wife, a son, a daughter, a father, or mother. Monotheism encouraged people to think in new ways. A monotheistic God, not tied to a concrete image, is a highly abstract concept. Abstraction is a crucial component of logical reasoning, and its use can set people free from superstition. But there's a terrible price to pay for devotion to an abstract God. If everyone agrees that only one God exists, and different groups conceive of him in different ways, then whose perception of that deity is the correct one? The question has goaded monotheists to wage war with an intensity and purpose never witnessed during the polytheistic cultures. Outside the monotheistic West, people have killed each other because they looked, dressed, or spoke or gestured differently. But killing solely because someone believes in a different abstract idea loosed into the world an odious impulse. Raiding another village because one aspired to steal horses has a practical logic. Killing each other over religious, philosophical, or economic abstractions is folly. If the skulls of the people who have been killed in the name of God, Jesus, and Allah in religious wars and persecutions could be piled in one place, they would form an immense mountain. If we tallied the cost of human suffering for the belief in monotheism, we might not think of the other religions of the world as primitive. Monotheism was a major advance along the road to enlightenment, but its cost was steep. Another thing that we lost along with monotheism were the female gods. Many of the, if you look at some of the old paintings on the walls in caves in Egypt, you saw many, many women being painted as the gods or goddesses, as it were, as the religious figures if they looked up to anybody. And they always looked up to lots of them. Usually it was many women that they looked up to. Now that we've become monotheistic, it's always a male or it has lots of male traits. I point this out because of the religious makeup that not only backs the current Trump administration, but also help put the Trump administration into the White House. 87% of the evangelical Christians in the United States voted for this guy, even though he clearly does not embody any of the things that Christ talked about in their own Bible. They went ahead and they voted for this guy anyway. The idea of God is a very abstract one because we don't have really any record of God. We've got the Bible, but Moses himself was an Egyptian prince. So it makes no sense that he was able to read off of the tablets at Mount Sinai because being Egyptian, the language that he would have been familiar with would have been hieroglyphics. And he wouldn't have been familiar with the alphabet. So obviously, and I get it, I'm punching holes in religion right now. But what we've ended up with is a whole lot of people in the belief, this abstract idea of God, right? And even though Jesus supposedly came from the Middle East, if you look at the pictures that Christians have drawn of Jesus, he's always been white, a long-haired white guy. And so now, and what we have now is we have people on the left side of the aisle arguing that we should all be in charge, right? That we should all have a say. And what we have on the right side of the aisle is that we should not. The government is bad, right? Democracy is tyranny. All of these people coming together and coming up with this, making this decision all together, that's a bad thing. But this very small handful, right, of millionaires and billionaires, these captains of industry, these masters of the universe, you know, these guys who are clearly blessed by God, which is evident by their wealth. That's the argument that we have coming from the conservative side of the aisle. And the conservative side of the aisle are these people that have this belief and in an abstract idea of God. And I think that the way that they follow Trump and his administration and everything they say and do says to me that they're beginning to look up to him as if he is that deity. And they're willing to give all praise to him, you know, all power to him, all glory to him, to that one person, because he knows better, right? He's got the money. He's got the fame. He is the guy. We know nothing. And they have a belief in a false prophet, and he's proving himself false. You have to open your eyes to see it, but those of us that are woke, we see it, and we see how damaging it is. And he's not just taking down you, the working conservative. He's taking down me too, the working progressive. He's coming for all of us.
I don't think hell exists. I happen to believe in life after death, but I don't think it's got a thing to do with reward and punishment. Religion is always in the control business. And that's something people don't really understand. It's in the guilt-producing control business. And if you have heaven as a place where you're rewarded for your goodness and hell as a place where you're punished for your evil, then you sort of have control of the population. And so they create this fiery place, which has quite literally scared the hell out of a lot of people throughout Christian history.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part of a control tactic.
But wait a minute, you're saying that hell, the idea of a place under the earth or somewhere where you're tormented for an eternity, is actually an invention the church?
I think the church fired its furnaces hotter than anybody else.
And that is what's happening now. I think this same religion with these abstract ideas and this idea that we can't have a democracy, that we have to have this very small handful of people in charge, you know, and it's largely white evangelical Christians that are promoting this idea largely. I think it's a very dangerous thing, and it has led us to a very dangerous place. And I have seen, because I am a student of history, I have seen what is at the end of this road. And if you listen to this show, you have very likely seen what is at the end of this road too. And it is not good. Everybody loves the idea of heaven, but nobody wants to die to get there. If you believe in heaven, if you think heaven is so great, well, then you go ahead and you go. It's waiting for you on the other side. You don't have to stay here and drag the rest of us through what we see as a hell. I don't think democracy is tyranny. I don't think that my countrymen are wrong. I just think that there is definitely a better way for us to do this. And it's going to involve all of us. I don't believe that the captains of industry, that the masters of the universe, really give a damn about us. I think it's up to us, we the people, and we hold all of the power. And only in a show produced by Melvin could we go from smartphones to talking about polytheism and hell. I'm glad you were with me for this. Ladies and gentlemen, I got to duck out of here. I've taken enough of your time, but I hope I planted a seed in your head today. And I hope you really think about these things. Because if you look at monotheism versus polytheism, and then if you look at democracy versus the non-democratic thing that a lot of conservatives are trying to push, you'll see that this really comes down to the type of person you are and the type of world that you want to live in. Thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store or on Podbean. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out there. You can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep a growing dialogue dialogue with our, to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. I've done this 1,000 times. You'd think I know this by now. Thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out. We will prevail. Rejected austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and special thanks to you for listening. This is Melvin signing off. And now that I have woken you up, stay woke. Good morning.